You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, delicious, dexterous dukes and duchesses of the digital den. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 228, and of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your verifiably va-va-voom vixens voracious for vocabulary and vuvuzelas.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris.
Without further ado, let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz, Hotshot. Here I have a random trivia pursuit card. You guys have your barnyard buzzers. And let's answer some questions. Here we go. Blue Edge for geography. In 1978, which publishing magnate held a fundraiser to save the then crumbling Hollywood sign?
78. Oh.
Chris.
William Randolph Hearst.
Incorrect.
Ah, it's the only publishing magnate.
That was a good guess.
Think about the West Coast. Colin.
Oh.
Hugh Hefner.
There you
Correct.
Go.
It is Hugh Hefner. Pink Wedge. Which African-American actor won the Oscar for Best Actor in 2002, a feat that hadn't occurred since Sidney Poitier won in 1963? Colin.
I believe that was Denzel, right?
Denzel.
Yeah.
What movie?
Denzel Washington, 2002. Was it for Philadelphia?
Was it the cop one?
Training Day.
Training Day.
Yellow Wedge. Which company acquired Yahoo in 2016 for close to $5 billion? Chris.
Was this Yahoo? Was this America Online?
Incorrect.
No, what Yahoo?
Dana.
Was it Microsoft?
Incorrect. No. Colin.
Was it AT&T?
It was Verizon.
Right. I knew it was one of those. Okay.
Purple Wedge. Who wrote the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas? The hint is it is not Alice B. Toklas.
Okay.
Colin.
I think that was Gertrude Stein, yes.
Correct. Gertrude Stein. Green Wedge for Science and Nature. Ew. Feline tapeworms can be spread to humans. True or false? Well, thumbs up for true, thumbs down for false. True. Colin, Dana, Chris. It is true.
Yeah.
Gross.
You could take a tapeworm and put it in a human.
you could take any worm and put it in a human.
Put any worm in a human.
Yeah.
Last question, Orange Wedge. In which city does the... Oh, God, we have so many tennis questions. All right. Colin, you're not allowed to answer. This is for Dana and Chris. Okay. This is another tennis question. In which city does the first of the four Grand Slam tennis tournaments take place each January?
Wow.
Which...
One.
Which of the Opens? Dana.
Is it Sydney? Because it's summer in January? No? Okay.
You are right that it's Australia.
Chris, it is Australia? But it's not Sydney?
It is Australia. Yep.
Canberra?
There's the capital of Australia, but that is incorrect. Melbourne! Yeah. Colin, can you name what the four tennis matches are in order? Starting with January.
All right. I mean, so let's just list them. All right. Okay. So this will help me think out loud here. All right. So we got Australian Open in Melbourne. We have Wimbledon in, of course, London, or thereabouts. We've got the US Open, which is in Flushing, in Queens, New York. And then we've got the French Open in Paris or thereabouts. So, man, okay. I feel like the US Open is the last one. So
Correct.
Let's see, what are the other ones? Okay, all right. So the middle ones, I think it's going to be Australian, French, Wimbledon, US Open.
That's you got it.
All right.
Yeah,
okay.
Nice.
Very impressive. Oh, good job, guys. So I have an amazing Purple Patreon patron pledge fact. Justin from Colorado Springs, he says, I love hot air balloons. I have crewed for pilots at the Albuquerque Balloon Festival.
Ah.
So here is his fact story. Justin says, when brothers Montgolfier were tweaking their hot air balloon design in 18th century France, they started doing test flights. After launching successful unmanned flights, of course, naturally, the next step was to launch animals. So they put a sheep, a rooster, and a duck into a hot air balloon and set it to the skies. The balloon rose to as high as like 600 meters and it traveled for like 2 miles and landed safely in a field. And then the animals then were inspected by a physician to make sure that they're all okay. You know, because they haven't sent a person up there, so they got to make sure, you know.
Sure, like, sure. Yeah,
all the
effects
are okay. And the doctor determined that they were alive and well. And so the three animals became pioneers of hot air balloon flight and paved the way for successful human flights of the future. For their brave efforts, the three animals were hailed as heroes and got to spend their remaining days at the menagerie in Versailles.
Oh, wow.
That is pretty cool. Like,
they have no idea what was going on.
No.
Like, and it was a scary day, and then we moved somewhere nice.
It was cold.
But, like, in all seriousness, though, that means that sheep was probably the highest that a mammal had ever been off the ground at that point.
At that time.
In recorded history.
It was the highest a mammal had ever been off the ground and then lived, probably.
Yeah.
For sure.
Because, like, we had catapults.
Or birds picking up mice or something like that.
Fair.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Yep.
I like these edge cases. All right.
Yeah.
The sheep was the edge case.
I love Chris's murder mystery. The sheep was the edge case.
I can imagine the cover already. You know, those James Patterson with the long serif font.
And it's like the shadow of a sheep. And
yeah,
it's
yeah,
just
yeah,
like
yeah,
peeking through a door or something.
Yeah, through a door.
Yes.
Through a door. Red embossed letters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, foil, little foil effect.
Sheep was the edge case. All right. Thank you, Justin from Colorado Springs, for your wonderful hot air balloon fact. This week's episode, Colin, you chose the theme.
I did. Today's episode, Lock and Key.
Woo!
And I'll give you guys a little behind the scenes here, dear listeners. You know, we try and generate these topics at least a few weeks before we sit down to record here. So we have a little, you know, group Google Doc going where we sort of brainstorm the topics and sort of subtopics ideas, and then we sort of flesh it out from there. Lock and Key just came to me and just almost in a flash, and I spilled out like 12 different subtopics that we could talk about. You know, anything from security to literal locks and keys, vaults, you name it. I thought that would be a fun topic for us. I'm looking forward to what you guys all talked about here, too.
Well, this week is a terrible topic for me because I lose my keys all the time. This week, it's lock and key.
So I have put together for you guys a grab bag quiz. I will start you guys off with a kid joke, dad joke. What kind of key do you use to open a haunted house? Skeleton. The answer, of course,
a skeleton key.
Oh, okay.
Key, a ghost right?
Yeah.
Key.
A ghost
a
key. All right.
A bookie?
Grab you guys barnyard buzzers here. Barnyard buzzers. Get them up. Get them ready. Why is it called a skeleton key? What and why?
Oh.
Dana.
Is it because it's the least amount of key information you can have on the key? So it's like missing parts of it in order to sneak through. It's like a bone almost.
That's exactly right.
Missing the little ridges on it.
What?
Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah, it's not, it is not, as I certainly did until just a few days ago, as a lot of kids do, it's not an allusion to it looking like a skeleton or a bone per se. It is an allusion to the fact that it is stripped down to the absolute bare minimum of what it needs to do its job. So let's talk about what a skeleton key is. What does a skeleton key do? What is the purpose of a skeleton key?
If you have a house where, you know, you have various different locks on the doors, the skeleton key should be able to open all of those.
It is a specific old type of lock. All right. So the most modern locks that we have, like in your house today, almost there's almost guaranteed that you have in your house a pin and tumbler cylinder style lock. Just it's kind of most of us think of when we think of a key, a lock and key, just a little ridge, you know, outline kind of looks like little mountains on the side there. So in contrast to that, another very old style of lock is called a warded lock or a warded padlock. And a warded key, a lock and key, it looks very much like a long rod with maybe kind of, you know, rectangular little pieces on the end. You stick it in and kind of click it around. It was basically a rotary design. And inside the lock, if you were to take the cover off, you would see it almost looks like sections of a maze. Okay. There are little like walls, the wards, and the indentations or sort of the outline of the key bits, the business end of the key, are designed to pass around those walls and slots and rotate to open the lock. So if the notches weren't in the right shape, it wouldn't turn. But really, underneath it all you had to do was just turn kind of the very last little bit of it. So a skeleton key was a key where the end of it, the shape of it that went in and touched the lock mechanism, had all of the parts missing where the wards would be, except for the one actual slot that did the work and turned
and
the lock.
And that's enough
open.
To rotate the thing.
That's right. Enough to rotate free and clear. That's right. And yeah, exactly as, you know, both Dana and Chris were saying. It's a key that has just the absolute minimal information to sort of do its job. It's a skeleton. It's been pared down.
I thought it was made from a bone.
Yeah. Okay, guess.
All right, moving right along. Get your buzzers ready. The 1983 AMC Renault Alliance was the first mainstream car available with what as a factory option?
Ooh.
What year?
No. 1983. Karen with a guess.
Is it like fingerprint lock?
Whoa. Chris with a guess.
I'm going to say it's keyless ignition.
That is a keyless entry. Keyless entry. I think you guys were dancing around it there. Yeah, that's right. Earlier than I thought. I kind of in my mind had this as like a 90s thing when I kind of went down chasing this one down. Yeah, according to the research I found, sort of the first mass produced, commercially available. Yeah, 83, the Renault and then the AMC, American Motor Cars kind of alliance there. And it was a fairly budget car. I mean, you go back and look at this car and it's, you know, very nondescript. It's not like a luxury car by any means, but sounds like it was infrared at first as opposed to a radio signal. So you really kind of had to be pointing it at the car, you know? It's like, you know, like your TV remote, I guess.
The earliest, video game, wireless video game controllers were infrared. So it's like you had to point them at a receiver. And of course, what everybody does with their video game controllers is they always keep them oriented exactly facing the TV, right? So no problem there.
I had a pair, I remember real early on, my first pair of wireless headphones way, way, way long ago was IR based. And it was so bad. It was like a $19 set of IR headphones. And I literally had to I couldn't turn my head more than maybe a 15 degree angle of arc and or the sound would cut out. I was like, this is go try to convince myself it's convenient.
You just can't move your head.
In 1983, also 1983, a big year for this quiz.
Yeah, we were one.
1983, the KBL Corporation of Massachusetts reached an agreement with DC Comics regarding the use of what trade name?
Huh.
All right, KBL Corporation reached an agreement with DC Comics for a new sort of trade
DC
name.
DC Comics. Justice League. Gotta be.
If you have ever been to downtown San Francisco, downtown New York, downtown almost any major city, I guarantee you have seen many of this company's inventions, products all around you.
What was that to do with DC?
I think this has to do with maybe armored cars.
Interesting.
Oh!
So what would that, in a comic?
Bat Tumbler.
Car, trade name?
No. I'm guessing that none of you know or live with a bike messenger. Yeah. Oh, man. Dana's got a guess. People in their cars right now are screaming at their radios. The answer.
Yes.
Well, Dana's got a guess. I don't think this is going to be right. They're going to be so disappointed. Is it a bike lock?
It is the Kryptonite bike lock. It is the Kryptonite bike lock. Yeah, then let me explain it to you in case you've never seen one. They are virtually ubiquitous in any big city these days. It is the U-shaped lock with a crossbar at the end. You run it through the frame, you attach it to whatever you want, and the illusion, of course, of the name is that it is super strong, super tough, super hard to get into. Early 70s, invented by a guy named Stan Kaplan. He, you know, his goal was basically to make an unbreakable bike lock. He just went ahead and called his product the Kryptonite Bike Lock. Never really got hassled by DC Comics about it.
Wow.
Built up enough of a following that he was, you know, making a good amount of money by this before it ever really became an issue. I don't think this would happen today. I feel like, you know, certainly not today's modern DC
Comics.
Cease
and desist at the get-go.
Right away. In 1983, after, you know, some back and forth, for sure. I mean, they ended up on DC's radar. DC and you know, Stan Kaplan and his company, they reached an agreement, really, which amazes me, that they allowed them to use the Kryptonite name for their bike lock, provided that they never, ever, ever use any Superman, Superboy, Supergirl, any of the Superman characters. They never used the word super. Mm. Okay, well, we'll stick with the Kryptonite company here. I hope this one goes well. Follow-up question. In 2004, the Kryptonite company was prompted to change their locking mechanism when it was discovered you could open a standard Kryptonite lock using what common item?
I heard about this.
Is it like a can of compressed air?
Oh, no, not a can of compressed air. A even more common item, something that you might even have in your backpack or on your desk or in your pocket. They discovered that using a Bic pen, the exact right diameter and radius to fit into the cylinder lock mechanism that Kryptonite had. And despite all of this vaunted, you know, security and how tough the lock was and the unbreakable steel and all that, you could literally jam a Bic pen tube in there, wriggle it around without too much finesse, to be honest with you, and open the lock. And it would just get the little
It's a skeleton key made out of a pen.
Yeah.
I saw this online and I was like, no way, I'm gonna go home. I've got like two or three Kryptonite locks at home. I went home, popped off the end of a Bic pen. It opened up. It took me 20 seconds to open this lock. I really couldn't believe it. So they were obviously, I mean, you know, embarrassed by this. In 1924, this company was granted a patent for its iconic stacked steel plate style padlock. Revolutionized the market.
Master lock.
Yeah, that's right. Master lock. Yeah, just that little, you know, the little stacked up little steel plate style, looks like a little stack of pancakes made out of metal. That was a real revolution in the consumer padlock industry. It's founded by Harry Soreff. He was a Russian immigrant.
Harry Master Lock.
Before it was Master Lock, he had a company called Master Key, which we'll get to in a second. Harry Soreff. Yeah, a Russian immigrant, by all accounts, an absolute grinder. He moved to the U.S. and just got to work, man. Taught himself the locksmith trade. He was a traveling locksmith. In the late 19-teens, he founded a company called Master Key. And Master Key did pretty much what the name implies, is they manufactured and sold a set of five keys that could open just one of the keys could open just about any mass-produced mass padlock on the market at the time.
He sold thieves' tools.
Look, Dana, it was every kind of bio I read about Harry Soreff here online says that, yeah, law enforcement was not necessarily that happy with him. They felt like he was selling tools to, you know, to burglars and thieves. But, you know, his position, I think, you know, fairly or not, was, look, I'm not the one making these crappy locks. Like, really, it was, you know, it was just the state of the industry. He kind of decided, though, I think at one point, maybe I'll make my fortune on the other end of this economy.
Now that I've sold you guys tools to break open. Now let me sell the other side locks to prevent these tools.
So his idea was to change how locks were made at the time. So at the time, you could get a good padlock. It was just very expensive because it was just a solid chunk of metal that had been, you know, drilled and tooled out to accept the lock mechanism. And, you know, the lock mechanism itself in all of these locks is not particularly complicated or secret or anything like that. It's protecting it. Like that's the core of having a good lock, is protecting the lock mechanism. So most people who didn't want to shell out for an expensive padlock would buy a cheaper lock, which was a perfectly fine mechanism, but it was just encased in a rather cheap metal sheet, basically. And it didn't matter how good the mechanism was if you could just bash the hell out of it with a rock or a hammer and just, crack it open. So Harry Soreff's idea was, okay, instead of the expense of, you know, casting and drilling something out of solid metal, what if we had lots of little steel plates and just stacked them up together and riveted them together and had them, each one was carved out to have the space for the mechanism. And it was much cheaper to produce, very strong, very durable. I mean, as I say, this was 1924. You can go to the store today and buy these little stacked steel plates, you know, style locks. It's a great, great, great design, heavy duty. Master Lock eventually became extremely, extremely popular. Of course, for your high school locker, the little combination.
That's a recurring dream in high school. And
forgetting the combination.
Forgetting it.
It's like, oh, what's the combination of this?
True or false? In most states, it is illegal to own a lock picking set.
Oh.
Wait.
Chris.
False. I feel like you have to be able to own a lock picking set to, you know, to pick locks when you, if you need to. And there's people you can hire.
No, I think it's true that you can't have it. Like, you can get in trouble if you're caught with a lock picking set.
In the strictest answer, true, false, the answer is false to my question. False. In most states, it is, in fact, legal to own a lock picking set outright. There are a handful of states where it is illegal or it gets more complicated. And here's where it gets complicated. And I'll use our own great state of California as an example. We're a very classic, typical example of the laws here. It is perfectly legal to own a lockpicking set on its own. It is not legal if you are in possession of a lockpicking set in commission of a crime or with intent to commit a crime.
Okay.
If I, you know, run into you on the street and you're just carrying a lockpicking set in your backpack, you know, that's fine. If I catch you breaking into the front door of my building and you've got a lockpicking set in your backpack, that is now a separate, a criminal charge there.
Right.
Okay, I see. Mm-hmm.
I found an entry here. This is the California Penal Code here I'm looking at. Penal Code, Title 13, Chapter 3. Here's a great term for you guys. Chapter 3, burglarious and larcenous instruments and deadly weapons.
I really burglarious. Like burglarious. I like burglarious. Yeah.
It's not hilarious. It's burglarious. It's burglarious. Listen to this. All right. So this is a section here. What do we got? This is 466. Every person having upon him or her in his or her possession a picklock, crow, keybit, crowbar, screwdriver, vice grip pliers, water pump pliers, slide hammer, slim jim, tension bar, lock pick gun, tubular lock pick, bump key, floor safe door puller, master key, ceramic or porcelain spark plug chips or pieces, or other instrument or tool with intent feloniously to break or enter into any building to define, that is what constitutes a burglarious or larcenous instrument or tool. And that is a misdemeanor.
Okay. They sound like skateboarding tricks. Like
it does, right. The tubular lock pick, the bump key, the floor safe door puller.
Bump key.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Did you guys see that Tony Hawk? Yeah, he was the first one to pull off a floor safe door puller in competition.
Right. Yeah. It was burglarious.
All right, I'll close you out here with the last one. Why is the vault in a bank called a vault? Why is it called the vault? The big room where you walk in, keep all the valuable stuff, thick doors. Why is it called a vault?
Okay, well, we have a gymnastics event.
Right.
Vault. Well, there's also pole vault.
So in the sense of jumping, right?
Hmm.
You can't jump over it.
You can't jump into it.
It is because historically the early vaults were down in the basement or underground where there were vaulted ceilings. It was just how the multi-level buildings were constructed, and it was the safest place of the building. Yeah, so it kind of just sort of stuck with the name of the room, even if it isn't literally with vaulted ceilings or down underground anymore.
That makes sense.
Even though it kind of still is for a lot of places. You guys know Underwriter Labs, kind of the institute that does a lot of testing of safety testing and fireproofing and, you know, all kinds of things.
The UL symbol.
Yeah, the UL symbol. That's right. You see on so many consumer products, UL, Underwriter Labs. They certify a whole just huge range of, you know, codes and performance standards for almost everything. One of the things that they provide certification for is vault specifications in the US at least. And they grade the vaults on how long it would take to break into. That's how your vault is graded. Like, you might have, you know, a 30-minute grade bake vault. Like, if you assume like a dedicated team is trying to burgle your vault, how long can this thing hold them off? And that's how they used to grade them. And
they must have like a bunch of experts as their QA.
Wouldn't that be the most fun job, seriously, to be on? What do you do? Well, I'm on the vault testing team for Underwriter Labs. I break into vaults for
a white hat.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, good job, guys. Mm. Good job. Well done.
All right, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You're listening to Good Job Brain. Smooth puzzles. Smart trivia. Good Job Brain.
We're back. You're listening to Good Job Brain, and this week we're talking about things that are locked up.
Well, speaking of vaults, things that are locked up securely in vaults, whenever I think of something like locked up really tightly, as securely as possible, or, you know, certainly us here in the United States, you might think of the expression like, oh, that they've got that locked up tighter than Fort Knox.
Or possibly
the expression like, whoa, I wouldn't do that for all the gold in Fort Knox.
So
let me ask you, what is Fort Knox?
I believe Fort Knox is where they stored all of our country, like the U.S. government, federal government's gold, and that was the gold that backed all of our currency, right? Mm-hmm. Until we went off the gold standard.
Okay. If you were to define Fort Knox, you would define it as a big building in which a whole lot of gold is stored on behalf of the United States of America.
Well, you know, when you say it that way, I guess you're making me think. Yeah, mm-hmm. I guess I would have to say, yeah, where is it? I don't know.
What is it? Where is it? What is Fort Knox? Does anyone want to guess why it's called Fort Knox?
It's a military.
It's an army base. Fort Knox is an army base, a fort, just south of Louisville, Kentucky. Okay.
Cool.
Fort Knox is a big army base. During the day, there's about 25,000 people there, soldiers, civilians, and family members of the soldiers that are stationed there. The funny thing about Fort Knox is that not in Fort Knox, but right next to Fort Knox, like across the street from Fort Knox, is a building called the United States Bullion Depository. So in a sense, we think about all the gold in Fort Knox. There is technically no gold in Fort Knox.
It's across the street.
It's actually at the intersection of Gold Vault Road and Bullion Boulevard. That's the street address.
Okay.
Practically inviting you to come.
Come on down. Just we're at the intersection of Gold Vault Road and Bullion Boulevard. Whereas in reality, they absolutely do not want you going there at all. So yeah, in the United States Bullion Depository, the only thing, it's this building, it looks like a big bank, you know what I mean? Except for it has guard towers on all four corners of it. And inside this incredibly secure facility is stored half of the United States holdings of gold. Half of it. There's two other mint facilities. There's at West Point, and I believe Denver is the other facility where the other bars of gold are stored. But Fort Knox has well over, it really has over half. It has a lot of gold. It is just a storage facility. They don't do any other business out of there. Mm. It is just a facility with a vault full of gold bars and some other things. Historically, like during, I believe, World War II, they moved the Constitution there. They moved, they've had other stuff stored there if they ever needed to keep it in storage. And the thing is, it's not coastal. It's very far away from like where other landing armies might land. It's in Kentucky. You know what I mean? It's even the location, that's another element of how secure it is. I should say, by the way, even the United States Mint, if you go to the official page of the United States Bullion Depository, even they occasionally call it by the nickname Fort Knox. Like, everybody kind of calls it that. It is currently home to 147.3 million ounces of gold and one penny.
Is the penny like a really special penny?
What's the penny? Oh, Karen, it must be a very special penny.
Is it the one from UHF? The Weird Al movie?
That's the one. You're just gonna have to keep thinking about what penny it could possibly be.
I mean, I can picture like a 1 ounce gold coin. Like I've held a 1 ounce gold coin, and there's how many? 100 and something million of those?
Yeah, there's fewer of the gold coins you might think, because actually a lot of the gold that's the gold bars in Fort Knox, they were derived from melting down the gold coins, the gold U.S. coins people actually used to use. I'll get to that in just a second. 147.3 million ounces of gold, approx. Mm. Now, the price of gold on the day we're recording this is $1,979.20 an ounce. So, and I pray that I did the math right here. That means it is 291,536,160,000 worth of gold in Fort Knox.
Wow.
So why do we have all this gold? Colin kind of alluded to this. This is basically, this is like in case our currency fails, right? The United States currency used to be on the gold standard, meaning that like it was all based on, we only issued as much currency as we had gold, literal gold, to back it up. Now, if that was a gold coin, you were holding the gold, you know? When we got off what was called the gold standard, that basically meant that now all of the money in the United States was worth something just because we said it is, because we all agree that it is.
Okay.
And if anybody were to ever disagree, you know, that would be extremely bad. So we've got this strategic reserve in case our currency, like, if it does fail, we at least have something to kind of to back it up, right? So the U.S. Bullion Depository, nicknamed Fort Knox, is indeed reputed to be the most secure place in the world. And I really wanted to like have a big discussion with you all about like all the different security systems that are in place at Fort Knox. So here we go. I don't know. Because it's all classified. And like there's the building and there's like a fence around the building, but it's like, other than that, like if you go to the Treasury Department website, it says the building is equipped with the latest and most modern protective devices. And the U.S. Mint's website says the actual structure and content of the facility is known by only a few. And no one person knows all the procedures. There's reports that there are automatic machine guns that fire if a laser is tripped. It's also said that there's landmines in the ground. So, but you don't know, and that in and of itself makes it more secure because you have no idea what you're even up against, right?
It's also across the street from like a giant
army installation.
Yeah.
With 25,000 people there. So if they need any backups, like you can get in, but I don't know how you're going to get out, right? So let's get back to that penny, which I know you've all been waiting for. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not going to tell you just yet, but in the U.S., let me here's a question. This is a good trivia question too. In the United States, if I were to go to the United States Mint and say, one penny, please, and they handed me a nice new 2022 penny, what metal predominantly makes up that penny that you would get this year? What metal is that penny mostly made
of?
From this year?
Ooh. I think it is mostly zinc.
Yeah, you're a poet and you didn't know it. I think it is zinc, and you're right. This has been the case since 1982. Prior to 1982, pennies were made out of mostly copper. Again, a precious metal. It used to be that, you know, a copper penny was about a penny's worth of, you know, ish copper, right? In 1982, the rising price of copper led us to switch over to copper-plated zinc. This came about after a different proposed solution in 1973. You might know I used to live in Japan. And the lowest coin denomination in Japan is 1 yen. And when you get one of these 1 yen coins into your hands, it's, you know, their version of a penny. It's something you realize something very, very interesting about this coin. It is very light. And you realize that is because it is made of aluminum. If you carefully place a 1 yen coin on the surface of water very carefully, it will not break the surface tension of the water. And it will float. But if you drop it, it falls in, right?
Yeah.
Then they don't weigh a lot in your pocket. You know, they feel like they're worth, you know, they're not really worth that much. And they feel that way. So in 1973, the United States Mint was like, hey, how about aluminum pennies? What if we were to try doing aluminum pennies? It was a good idea, but they just can't just do that on their own because Congress has to pass a law that says that. So they had to try to convince Congress that this was a good idea. So in 1973, they made a bunch of aluminum pennies that were stamped 1974 because that was the year they were proposing to put them into circulation. And they gave some out. They started giving some out as samples to Congress people, U.S. Treasury officials, maybe some other people too. Like, you know, they weren't really kind of keeping good track. Maybe you know somebody who knows somebody who can get you an aluminum penny. So they gave out a bunch to try to like generate interest in the aluminum penny. For various reasons, they do not go with the aluminum penny. Vending machine companies were like, this might be a problem. It might be difficult to actually like accept these. Additionally, even doctors were like, you know, kids ingest coins a lot. It's hard to find aluminum on an x-ray. I'm not really sure how big of a problem that really would have been, but you know, that was one of the things that was raised and they didn't do it. So the Mint is like, oh, okay, oops, can you give us back those 74 pennies? And they got some of them back, but they had been a little loosey-goosey about who was getting them, so they actually didn't get them all back. So right now there are three of these that are out there that are known about, or there are three surviving ones that are known about.
Whoa.
One is in the Smithsonian, only three that are known. The one is in the Smithsonian as part of their sort of numismatic, you know, collection. One of them, I believe, is still in the hands of a former member of the U.S. Capitol Police. And the story that he tells is, in 1973, a congressperson accidentally dropped one in the hallway. And he picked it up and he said, you want this back? And the congressperson looks back, looks at it, thinks, oh, what, a dime? You know, because it's, you know, I don't need a dime. Congressperson says, no, you keep it. And he runs off because he's got somewhere to be. So this guy ends up with the aluminum penny. And the other one. The other one was apparently given to an employee of the Denver Mint upon his retirement. And it's the only one known that's stamped 1974D for Denver, right? Mm. And the guy took it on his retirement, given it to him at the retirement party, put it in a baggie, like a sandwich bag, with some other coins that he had held onto. And the guy's son gets it, keeps it in the baggie. Decades later, the guy's son, like, looks at the, oh, I should probably try to, like, sell these old coins of my dad's, you know? And finds out what it is. And this is in the year 2014. Heritage Auctions, the big pop culture auction house, coins, comic books, video games, all that kind of stuff, he's going to auction it through Heritage, and they make a big deal about it. We're going to auction a 1974 aluminum penny. It's going to be huge. It's probably going to go for millions of dollars to coin collectors. Right before the auction, the U.S. Mint says, the government comes in and is like, this is government property. You don't, we need this back. Like, you don't get to have this. Sorry. And we don't know what happened, but we know that the owner ended up settling. They worked something out. But anyway, the U.S. Mint took repossession of the 1974D aluminum Lincoln cent, and they placed it, as it turned out, into the United States Bullion Depository located across Gold Bullion Boulevard from Fort Knox. Now, the contents of Fort Knox are also generally kind of kept a secret in terms of like the other stuff that might be in there. So there is a reason why we know the penny is in there. And this is interesting, too. And it kind of leads to another interesting fact about Fort Knox, which is that you can visit Fort Knox, the military fort, but the United States Bullion Depository is not open to visitors. There's way, you don't even get close to it at all, unless you have, or unless you're like the VIP of VIPs or have a really serious in. There have been, in the last century, civilians have been inside the vault, like a reported 3 times. Like, FDR went in there in 1943. Huh. In 1974, there was a conspiracy theory circulating that there was no more gold in Fort Knox because nobody had been in there or seen it. There was a congressional delegation, including some members of the news media, who went into the vaults to do sort of a formal inspection to see, that gold's still there. Yep. And that was the last time. 74 was the last time until 2017. What happened in 2017 was, you'll never believe this, was a little bit of a governmental scandal, because then Secretary of the Treasury, Steven Mnuchin, decided that as part of his official duties as Secretary of the Treasury, that he needed to go look at the gold. Just needed to do it.
Yeah.
He just needed to go down there and check it out. Now, no Secretary of the Treasury had felt this need since 1948, but he was like, you know what? I should really go check this out, you know.
Yeah.
And my wife needs to as well. And you know, it's in Kentucky, so Senator, you know, Mitch McConnell from Kentucky, he should go too. And then the governor of Kentucky, well, he can come along.
I should really,
this other guy from Kentucky and this other person from the Treasury, they got to go look at it too. And we got to take a military plane because, I mean, how do you get to Kentucky? We'll just have to take this. This Gulf Stream, you know. And so they went and they had a grand old time going down to the vault, getting their pictures taken in front of stacks of gold bars, writing their little names on the wall because they were there. And it just so happened, coincidentally, that this trip was on August 21st, 2017. That was the day of the total eclipse of the sun. And it just so happens that, you know, that the United States, Fort Knox is basically just off the path of totality. So it turned out that it was a really good, you know, way of viewing the eclipse. They were like, no, we're not actually interested in that. Oh, okay, sure. But it was kind of a head scratcher. Like, why did you go? Why were you there again? Can you explain like what the purpose of this trip was? So people filed a Freedom of Information Act request to find out why it all happened. And look, there's some pictures of him and his wife watching the eclipse from Fort Knox, where they got their little eclipse glasses on and everything, which is, I mean, to be fair, at least they were wearing the eclipse glasses. Yeah. So the itinerary was actually where things get interesting, because they viewed an empty vault compartment so they could get a sense of what it was like empty. And then they also took them to a separate vault compartment in which they stored all the other stuff that is not just bars of gold. And in this compartment were, all these things are actually kind of interesting, 10 1933 Double Eagle gold coins. These were never officially released. These were also things that somebody ended up with, and the U.S. Mint was like, nope, you got to give it back. Yep. 20 Sacagawea gold dollar coins. Not the gold-colored Sacagawea dollars, but actually ones that were actually made out of gold that had been to space. They were taken up on a NASA mission to space. Nice. And those were in the depository. And one 1974D aluminum penny listed on the, listed. This is in the Freedom of Information Act, you know, sort of dump. Incredible. Of like what happened.
Incredible.
So really, The phrase should not be, I wouldn't do it for all the gold in Fort Knox. It would be, I wouldn't do it for all the gold and the single aluminum penny in the United States Bullion Depository adjacent to Fort Knox. So get it right.
Is there a valuation of that aluminum penny? Like, how much would it be worth?
I mean, it would go for millions of dollars. It's hard to say because you get to that point where it's like somebody, I mean, it's not just like people who collect coins, right? I mean, there's also all kinds of like, you know, like hedge funds and things like that. Like some of their money is kept in coins. So, I mean, who knows what might happen if, two of those hedge funds started competing over who gets to own this. It really, the sky is kind of the limit.
Right. Mm. Just if they were interested in flipping the coin, if you will, Chris. Yeah.
No, I will not.
I want to see a heist film about a team breaking in to steal the penny, not to just steal the gold. Penny. I want to see the one penny heist. Yeah. I want to see like, that's their mission, you know, in like little tiny duffel bag carrying it away.
I think we talked about the best way to get it out is swallowing it because it doesn't show up on
X-ray. Yeah, you're right. You can't find it on an X-ray. Yeah. That's right.
Oh my gosh.
That's brilliant.
We're halfway there. We almost got it, guys.
The One Penny Heist by Colin Felton.
The follow-up to The Sheep Was the Edge Chase.
Calling all kids in the car. Brittany and Meredith here from the chart-topping Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast. Are you dreading another silent car ride with the fam? We've got the cure. 3 rounds of fresh trivia every single week. Movies, music, even science and Disney. We've got something for every trivia buff in the car. No more crickets chirping on those long journeys. The Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast is your secret weapon for connecting and laughing with kids of all ages, teens, toddlers, adults, it doesn't matter. Spark their curiosity and challenge their brains with every episode. New episodes drop weekly wherever you get your podcasts. Search for the Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast and turn those car rides into epic adventures.
I want to talk about secret recipes, formulas of foods. But I'm going to start off with a quick quiz. And these are all about food products that have rumored to have a very secret recipe. Ooh, so get out your barnyard buzzers. Here we go. Question number one. This liqueur has been made by the Carthusian monks since 1737. Reportedly to have 130 herbs and plants and flowers in their ingredients list. Chris.
That's the freaking name of this. Is it Frangelico?
No.
Yeah, there's a lot of these.
In the bottle in the shape of a monk. He's married to Mrs. Butterworth, right? No, what is it?
Wait.
It is also name of a Crayola crayon color.
Is it chartreuse?
It is chartreuse. Ooh. Chartreuse, yellow, green. Rumors have it that only two people of that monastery know all the ingredients and how to make this liqueur.
Have you ever had it? Have you guys ever tried it?
Yes. Yeah. Sure tastes like 130 herbs all smashed together.
I can taste maybe 90 tops here. Yeah. Yeah.
It's very medicinal, let's say. Very medicinal. Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of medicines and pharmacies, chemists William Henry Perrins and John Wheely Lee initially abandoned this concoction in their basement for several years. Dana.
Liam Perrins?
What's the concoction?
Oh.
Is it Worcestershire sauce? No.
It is!
Yeah.
How do you guys say it?
I say Worcestershire.
Worcestershire, yeah.
Worcestershire.
Worcestershire.
I mumble
Worcestershire.
It, and people seem to know what I'm talking about.
I
mumble it
too. It's fluid.
Yeah. They call it wussy sauce. Yes, it is made with a bunch of different ingredients and fermented for a very long time. So,
Were they British? Is it American? Where is it from?
So the sauce is like reportedly it's inspired by Asian fish sauces, Roman fish sauces, like kind of the fermented sauce. But yes, Leon Perrin's born out of England.
Okay.
All right. Next food item. Food historians believe that the original recipe of this company's signature breakfast food contained mashed potatoes, shortening, and fluffed egg whites.
Signature breakfast.
Breakfast food. You just tell me the company.
Mashed potatoes and egg whites and
shortening.
Shortening.
Mashed potatoes, egg whites, shortening. What's the company?
Fluffed egg whites for fluffiness.
Okay.
Chris?
At McDonald's?
Incorrect. What food? What food item were you thinking of?
Hash brown. I don't know.
Is it more egg oriented or potato oriented? Like what?
It's more flour oriented.
Is it Bisquick?
It is Krispy Kreme. Krispy Kreme donuts.
That's the original recipe.
Potatoes and eggs.
This was the initial original recipe from a very long time ago. So obviously things have changed. I've read somewhere that they haven't changed their recipe for their original glazed donuts since 1945 or since the 1940s.
Wow.
But initially the donut was made.
Took out the
made...
nicotine. Yeah.
See the old Southern gentleman up by the corner said, "Times sure have changed and nobody wants to eat the potato donut anymore."
With lead icing.
So next question. The secret ingredient of this fictional drink is cough syrup.
Oh, yes, yes.
Chris.
The Flaming Moe. Or the Flaming
Moe. Flaming Homer, Flaming XYZ from The Simpsons. The secret ingredient was cough syrup. Next question. Though the ingredients are common, Vietnamese refugee David Tran never trademarked the name of this food. However... Go ahead, Colin.
I think that's sriracha sauce.
It is sriracha sauce. Sriracha sauce. The rooster, the green cap rooster sriracha sauce. He never trademarked the term sriracha. So a lot of other people can use sriracha. But also sriracha is like the name of like a Thai town. So it's not, you know, it's not like something he came up with. However, he has made secretive modifications on the machinery to process the ingredients. So
I think it's the best taste for him. He's like, he didn't trademark it, but he's still the market leader anyway. He's like, whatever. Yeah, go ahead, make your own. I'm good. Yeah.
This is the top selling soda in Scotland for the past century. And it's made of a secret blend of 30 flavor agents and a very strong yellow and red food coloring. Surpassing Coca-Cola. Chris.
It's Iron Brew.
It is Iron Brew. Iron Brew. The national beverage of Scotland is whiskey, and this is the number two.
Please spell it for our listeners here in case they want to Google it.
I believe it's
it.
IRNBRU, right?
Iron Brew. Another beverage, Charles Algerton, came up with this formula in Texas in 1885. And it does not contain prune juice. Dana.
Is it Dr. Pepper?
It is Dr. Pepper. No prune juice. It's just a blend, secret blend of, again, many flavor agents and essential oils. I don't know. I don't think it tastes like prune juice.
Like, it has like a plummy something to it. Like
a raisiny quality to it. Very, very popular in its birthplace in Texas. All right. Last question on this quiz. Duke is the mascot dog, Golden Retriever, who often tries to out the secret family recipe for this brand. Chris.
It's Bush's Baked Beans.
Yes, Bush's Baked Beans.
What a silly, successful ad campaign. I you know what I mean?
Yes. The dog trying to sell the secret family recipe for profit. It's very strange. So I do want to talk about secret recipes and how companies go and protect their secret formulas and recipes and ingredients or however they process it. And growing up, we've heard a lot of myths and legends surrounding the KFC formula, the Coca-Cola formula. Mm-hmm. Only two people in the company know half of the recipe. Yeah.
And they weren't allowed to like fly together. Plane. Right. Exactly. Right, I always heard that. I was like, I don't know. It makes for a great story. I don't know if that's true or not.
The secret recipe, the paper is split into many pieces and given to different people, you know, people around the world. And they must, it's just, it's very theatrical. But are they true? And no. The answer is they're true-ish. So for example, Coca-Cola, the company, does actually have a rule about only two or a few executives knowing the formula. But it's not like one person knows half and the other knows half. Like they do know how to, independently of each other, they do know how to make Coca-Cola, or, you know, they've remembered the recipe just in case if anything happens. KFC, their spice mix is mixed in three different facilities. Is that because that's just how food production works, or is that like really like trying to protect a secret? And so much of this is marketing and generating this feeling of mystery and mystique.
Because in the end, it kind of doesn't matter. I mean, you know, there's a lot of like colas on the market that taste pretty much like Coke, but it's not going to. It has nothing to do with like the, you know, nailing the flavor exactly, and everything to do with the branding, right?
Yes,
or KFC, like people aren't going to just stop. If somebody, oh, my chicken tastes exactly like KFC spices, people are going to be like, stop going to KFC.
Yeah. So that's exactly it. So say you discovered the age-old initial recipe for Coke. You know, what are you going to do?
Yeah, what are you going to do with it? Right,
you
exactly.
Have to go get you have to go get some cocaine, first of all, to make it work.
Obviously, ingredients have changed. You know, the way to process ingredients have changed. The scale of production have changed.
That's so really,
actually, a lot of companies probably display the first initial recipe somewhere. Like Coca-Cola actually does have a museum experience where they built like a big fake vault. And they have like the recipe in like glass enclosures and stuff. And like Chris said, okay, so you've made your you made fried chicken that tastes exactly like KFC and it's delicious. Oh, do you have the distribution methods? Do you have the mass production methods? Do you have the brand recognition of Coke?
Totally.
And to Dana's point, in Maywood, New Jersey, the city of Maywood, stands one chemical plant. And that is the only place currently that possesses the necessary permits from the DEA and the government to import cola leaves from Peru, remove the cocaine from the leaves, and the cocaine-free extract is exclusively sold to Coca-Cola Company.
Mm. I didn't actually know that they still put cola leaves in it.
Yes, cola leaf extract, cocaine-free cola leaves extract. So if you know, good luck getting your hands on that. You know, it's already hard enough to get some of the chemicals in these things. Cocaine-free cola leaf extract
that
is
really
extra
fascinating.
Hard. Yeah, one place. Yeah. But say you do have some sort of secret formula or a great recipe for something and you want to protect it. How are you going to go about and do that? Maybe some people are like, oh, I'll copyright it. Well, copyright doesn't really work that way. Copyright protection, it helps protect artistic works.
You cannot copyright a list of ingredients. Yeah,
exactly. But you can copyright a collection of recipes in a cookbook that has your notes, the author's notes and stories and commentary. So you're like, okay, well, I can't really copyright this recipe. Well, let's trademark it. Well, trademark doesn't work like that. Trademarks are to protect names or brands or logos. Mm-hmm. Do you guys remember Dominique Ancel, the bakery in New York City?
They
invented the Cronut.
Yeah.
So the Cronut name is obviously protected. You see a little mark now, the Cronut. No one can call it a Cronut. People call it the other stuff, like a dosant or like.
But you can go to Safeway and buy their version of it in their bakery.
Croissant donut. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. There's no protection against somebody reverse engineering your recipe.
Yes,
basically.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, let's patent. I got this recipe. I'm going to patent my recipe. Okay, well, patents is all about novelty and originality and inventing something that never really had a precedent before. So there have been food patents, but mostly in like the method of preparing food that is really revolutionary. Processing, if you get a patent, that's out in the open for the public to see. So
that's right.
So
right,
then other
right.
people are going to see all your info if you can, if you decide and can and get a patent for your secret recipe. Mm-hmm. So where does that leave us? Most companies and most people who have like secret formulas or secret recipes, they classify it as a trade secret.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Insider knowledge that gives your business an advantage. Mm. And there usually is a monetary value assigned to it. And so that's where a lot of the protection comes from. So to enforce the secret, this is why maybe if you go visit Coca-Cola, you know, the kitchen or whatever, the labs, you have to sign NDAs. People who work at these companies have to sign non-disclosure agreements or other contracts or confidentiality agreements, and you just have to enforce it with a lot of legal paperwork.
So it makes the country run. Yeah.
Hmm. And Dana, you got our last segment.
Yes. So I have a question for y'all. What do you bring with you when you go out, when you leave the house? What are the things that you always bring with you, and how do you carry those things around?
Wallet, okay. keys, phone. Mm-hmm. Those are the three. Mm-hmm. I say it to myself in my head every time I step out the door. Wallet, keys, phone. And it's yep. I have my pockets.
Pre-pandemic, I used to have like coins in my really? Pocket with my keys. Yeah, mm-hmm. but like, you know, whatever coins I was using. But then we kind of like, I don't know, I don't pay cash for anything anymore.
Exactly.
You know? It's like we order everything, and it's not like I'm not going physically to a lot of stores and buying things in cash. So now it is just keys, wallet, cell phone.
I have a purse, and in my purse I have toys for my kid when we go out somewhere. I have tissues and cough drops and sunglasses.
Wow.
And a bunch of mom stuff. Oh,
this is
in
it's
there.
The full mom purse now, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Where you're just like, oh, were you hungry? And like you pull a sandwich
there's
out
a
of
snack in there. Yeah. I also have like lottery tickets that I haven't turned in yet for cash. Like I mean, people have always needed to carry stuff around, but imagine it's 200 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
And your clothes don't have pockets. There are no purses, but you still have like your wallet, keys, not phone, but like your watch or your whatever that you need to carry around. What do you do with it? And you're fancy. You get yourself a mega chunky fancy chain and you just strap all of the stuff to your body. It's just dangling from your body from chains.
It sounds like you're describing a utility belt almost.
It sounds like in the 90s where I had the chain wallet in my Janko jeans.
It's like that. But then there's like maybe up to 20 more chains dangling from it. And there's all sorts of other stuff troll around town.
What you're saying is the original keychain was actually a big chain that you strapped to your body and keys on it. Okay.
So people, especially women, but men also, in the 17th and 20th centuries, wore this thing called a chatelaine. It means like lady of the house or lady of the castle, because around that time, like the woman of the house would have all of the keys to all of the doors and the chests and the everything in the house. Like one person has it, it's her. So she has this giant janitor key ring that she carries around all over the house. And then other people were like, you know, I could use like a big old key ring stuck to my body. And so they're called chatelaines.
The ring or the entire apparatus belt?
It's
all
the whole apparatus. Okay. I was doing research on like Art Nouveau jewelry, and I was like, what is this octopus thing with all these chains on it? What is this
I've seen
about?
That before. I never really processed that.
And they were like, it's a chatelaine. And I was like, that's interesting. And then you see pictures of people, and they're just like covered with everything. So here's a non-exclusive list of the things that might be dangling from your chatelaine. There's your keys, watch, mirrors, scissors, perfume, scent dampener comes up a lot, like the little vinaigrette, because everybody's real stinky at the time. So you have that hanging from it.
Dampener.
You got pillbox, a pencil, a notebook, a whistle, a pocket knife, multi-tool, a magnifying glass, a paintbrush, paint set, a locket, a full-on sewing kit with needles, pins, thimbles, a coin purse, charms, ironically, of a fake key to like as a nod to this was once a key ring and not like all of your possessions hanging from your body. And then, like, a thermometer, and safety pins. And there's more. Anything you could think of.
Yeah, everything I could possibly need. The only problem is I can't physically move
anything.
It's 50 pounds.
Yes. Yes.
I'm anchored to the ground. Yeah.
So way it was attached to your body, like the dresses had a wide belt on it. And so it would either have like a belt buckle type thing, or like a little hook, or it's like a brooch. And it's super ornate and made of jewels. And all of the fanciest jewelers made their own. So it's like you're just
It's part status symbol.
Part set. And so, yeah, so like you're jangling around and people are like, a fancy lady is.
Oh, yeah. I hear her coming a block away. Yeah. Right.
Made of gold and silver and sometimes bejeweled with the beautiful sculpture.
It's like a body size charm bracelet slash.
Yes. Yes. On your waist.
Yes. And people are like, well, it made sense because the dresses didn't really have big enough pockets to carry any of this. Huge amount of stuff that you actually need, or the purses were very small. And so, you know, what got rid of the shiny lanes is they invented bigger purses.
You know what?
Yeah. They were in fashion for like 200 years. People wore these. It wasn't a fad. It was like a normal part of everyday dress. They hadn't invented wristwatches, larger purses, or like bigger pockets. And so you just had to wear all of it on your body on a chain.
And find excuses to use, you know, your magnifying glass and your whatever. Hang on. I've let me get this. I've got my magnifying glass right here.
All right. I have a few trivia questions about keychains for y'all to just round it out. All right. Room 237 is often written on keychains related to which book or movie? Colin.
That is The Shining.
The Shining. This thing might appear in your key ring, but the name for it comes from a German phrase for spring hook.
Spring hooking.
You're really close. The end is right, but not helpful for guessing the word.
Spring is jump in German, but what is... Oh, what is it?
It's a carabiner.
Oh.
In German, it's a Karabinerhaken, a spring hook. Yeah.
Oh, Karabinerhaken.
Yeah. Colin.
If you had just said Karabinerhaken,
Got it. Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
Last question. This smash hit keychain toy of the 90s won the Ig Nobel Prize, which is a satiric prize in 1997 for diverting millions of person hours of work into the husbandry of virtual pets.
Tamagotchi.
The Tamagotchi.
Does Tamagotchi mean anything in Japanese, Chris? Or is it
little egg? Tamago is egg.
Of course.
Yes.
I had one.
Me too.
Really?
Yeah. I got a first gen when I was like 16 and in high school. It died while I was working a shift at the grocery store.
And I had to, like,
Tamagotchi
where were
is dying,
you...
and like, yeah, where yeah. were you when your first Tamagotchi died? I was like checking. It was like thing was like I'm like at the grocery store and it's like beeping and I know it's dying and I'm just like, oh no, and I'm like checking somebody out and I'm just like, well, you know,
that's
ignore
life.
It. Yep.
And that's our show. Thank you guys for joining me. And thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned stuff about chatelaines, about Fort Knox, about locks and keys and secret recipes. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and on all podcast apps. And on our website, goodjobbrain.com. This podcast is part of Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other shows like Big Picture Science, Clever, and the Explorers Podcast. And we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that. because you're already listening to a podcast.